Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here, talking about legal documents today, and we're not going to put you to sleep. We're not going to put you to sleep.
No, we're not. You know, we're not going to talk about legal documents today. Okay. So maybe we are, because we're going to bring an awesome attorney on that's going to speak about that. He owns gyms. He owns a business. He's done real estate. He helps put together legal docs for syndications. And so, super qualified guy. But really what we're going to get to the heart to today is, how do you really evaluate how to do business
Absolutely.
With, who to do business with, how to do business with them? How do you pick an operator? I think we get to the heart of that. Very, very fun conversation, very lively. We kind of cut through all the noise and make it very applicable to you. But I also think, we kind of, towards the end of the show, we really get into mindset and how it plays into sort of this stuff. But Tate, great guest. I think we really nailed a lot of issues on really like in your investment journey in this space, like how you're going to sort of think about things as a pilot or as a high income earning professional that's listening to the show.
Yeah. I mean, this is an episode that I think is going to help people become more sophisticated.
Yeah.
And a lot of our listeners are stepping into the world of private placements, alternative investing, and you need to be armed with the right knowledge, both from a technical aspect, but more as well as subjective. There's subjectivity to a lot of this private world, right? So anyway, Seth Bradley, Esquire, is a securities attorney and real estate entrepreneur who has closed billions of dollars in real estate transactions over the past decade. And prior to building his own boutique SEC law firm, Raise Law, he worked at a top three globally ranked firm. Seth is an absolute wealth of knowledge, and looking forward to the conversation.
Let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Seth, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, brother. Good to see you. Thanks for having me on.
You as well. It's always been a good time. Man, I always have the best time with you when we're at conferences because, first of all, you're just, one of the more interesting people in the real estate space. You're also really spooled up on the legal side and everything else going on in the industry. So excited to just jump into this today. We gave a little bit of background on who you are in the intro, but would love to hear it from your perspective. Who are you? How'd you get into this? And tell us a bit about your background.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, I appreciate it. I'll start pretty far back, but I'll try to get through it real quick just because I think it paints a good picture about like where I came from and where I'm at now. I was adopted at 3 months old from South Korea and ended up in West Virginia. I was the only Asian basically in the entire state. So you can imagine what that was like growing up. Great place, but has its challenges, right? But I always grew up kind of thinking that, W-2 is the only way to go. Spending, time for cash is the only way that you can make money. So I always just decided, what's the biggest and best job that I could possibly get? And to me, that was to become, in my mind, there's a lot of pilots out there listening right now, but in my mind, it was to become a doctor. So I went that pathway, went to med school for a little bit, about a year and a half, and I dropped out because I hated it. Just hated every second of it. I knew it wasn't for me. Ended up switching gears and saying, well, what's the next best job that I can get? And in my mind at that point in time, it was to become an attorney. So I went down that pathway. In between those two things, I got my MBA, but then I went to law school, did really well there, actually enjoyed it a little bit, and went into big law. So I have big law pedigree, worked in big law firms for about 7 years. That's when I started discovering real estate, did kind of the bigger pockets, purple Bible,
yep.
Typical track that people get into, house hacked into a duplex, started buying single family, fixing flips, things like that, working my way up to bigger multifamily, eventually investing passively in deals, and then raising capital for other folks, and then becoming an operator, all while working full-time as an attorney. That took its toll. I ended up getting fired from my last big law firm job because... you can't bill 2,500 hours a year at a big law firm and, run a real estate business just kind of passively on the side. It's just not how it works. So got involuntarily shown the door and it was the best thing that could happen to me. So I started my own boutique law firm called Raise Law and really dove into real estate head first. So that actually opened up a bunch of doors for some startups and other things I got involved in. But You know, real estate's always at the base of all of that.
Seth, like, that's a great story there of you, you know, working another job and kind of finding your passion. And I think that's really fantastic. I think a lot of pilots can relate to that. I mean, they can and they can't, right? I mean, we have a tremendous amount of flexibility to where, you know, maybe we don't have to become active operators and active real estate owners, but we can actually have the flexibility to put in a significant amount of time into a hobby or listen to this podcast or take action on things. So I think that's really relatable. I think what's interesting though, too, is like, I love attorneys who are operators and or operators that are become attorneys because, you know, it's academic versus practical or realistic.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's so fascinating that you've actually gone through and been a real estate investor, worked at a firm. Now you have your own firm. You know, let's kind of brings us to where we are today, right? Which is we have a lot of listeners who invest in syndications. They do these private placements and, you know, these private placements, these alts, these private equity deals, whatever it is. And, you know, I think people start to realize like this isn't just going on to Charles Schwab and clicking a button and having, you know, a selection in your portfolio to a stock bond or mutual fund. This is like a whole new world. And there's all types of things that the government allows us to do, right? When you don't have a registered security. In other words, you don't go on a publicly traded thing and buy a share of Tate or my self-storage deals, right? And so there's all these like kind of rules that go along with, you know, kind of how does a sponsor qualify an investment? How do you qualify as an investor to do the investment? Can you kind of speak to that? I mean, how, you know, kind of, because I think a lot of people get into this space and they're like, wait, I got to get an accredited investor letter. I've got to, you know, what this one allows accredited investors. This one doesn't allow
document.
Accredited.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is this document I got to, you know, it says I'm signing a subscription agreement that kind of attests that I've read a bunch of stuff. I really want to kind of unpack that because I think this is a new world for a lot of people. And like, as exciting as real estate investing is, you know, these documents are very meaningful. And I don't think we spend enough time sort of, hey, when you open up your documents, this is kind of the things that are kind of normal. And this is the process, right? And so, you know, kind of speak to that from a high level standpoint, kind of how these things are all kind of set up and work together.
Yeah, for sure. And I did want to just note that I am a securities attorney, but I'm not your guys' attorney or anyone else's that's listening. But I do have a good amount of info and background on this. And, you know, all those protections are in place, these 100-page documents, these PPMs that are just, they seem like endless whenever you pick the first one up and look at it. You're like, you really expect me to read this entire thing along with this 75-page operating agreement and then all these other ancillary docs that you're like, I don't even know what these are. Like, if you've never done it before, it's just overwhelming, right?
It's kind of like, but, it's kind of like reading the iTunes just, agreements that you sign, right? Right?
Yeah. Like, I'm sure everybody right. reads. Can that. I just check the box? Yeah. Like, show me where to sign.
Yeah.
Right. It's insane. I can relate because when I first started as an attorney and I looked at a different document, like a commercial lease for the first time, and it was about 100 pages. I was like, what? Like, you want me to read this, review it, like comment on it, like extract it? It was just absolutely insane. But just like anything else, like once you've done it a number of times and you get those reps, it gets easier every single time because you know what to expect. You know where to look. You know what's important and what's not. And you can kind of get through it a lot quicker. But, you know, speaking to the big picture stuff, I mean, the reason those documents are so long, the reason there's so many safeguards in place, the reason you hear about, you know, different exemptions you have to file for or all these different protections and qualifications that you have to have, it's really set up to protect the investors. I mean, that's what it's there for. That's why these regulations exist. That's why the SEC is out there. And that's why they regulate these private investments. Because the public markets, yes, they are also very highly regulated, but they are public. So they're out there. You see them. But they also want to regulate the private markets, which you don't generally see. Like, they're hard to access. They're private for a reason. And you have these safeguards in place so that people don't get taken advantage of. Especially non-accredited investors. Now, the SEC cares a lot more about non-accredited investors than they do accredited investors because they kind of put those people in a different bucket and think that they can kind of fend for themselves to a certain extent. But really, just know that all these different hoops you have to jump through to get involved with these deals, it's there in place to protect you as the investor.
So, Seth, you said an accredited investor. I think the majority of our listeners at this point know what that is. But for anybody that doesn't, do you want to just fill people in on what that is?
Yeah, for sure. Accredited investor is really just something defined by the SEC. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can qualify as one, and it changes and is continuing to evolve and change. But they just it's really something that is a qualification whereby you qualify as being able to invest, right? So like they think if you hit these certain thresholds, you're able to invest, and they feel comfortable with you investing in these private types of deals.
In non-public market securities.
That's right. That's right. And the ones that you've most likely heard of are, you know, the income and the net worth test, which, you know, the income test, $200,000 a year for the previous 2 years with a reasonable expectation of the same for the next year, or $1 million in net worth, not including your primary residence. Those are the two that you generally hear. Of course, there are others. You know, if you are certain certifications, and this is relatively new within the last few years, where you can have a Series 7 or Series 65 or Series 82, and you automatically qualify as an accredited investor as well. And they're also trying to expand that definition even further. And with the current administration, they probably will before they get out of office.
Excellent.
Yeah. And real quick before we go on to, I know we're going to dive deep into accredited and non-accredited investor and how you qualify and the nuances to that. You said something to me that I just want to kind of pick into a little bit, which is you said these PPMs protect the investor. What do you mean by that? What protections are generally given to the investor because of a PPM?
Sure. And I'll say that, you know, it does protect the investor, and that's primarily what it does, but it also protects the sponsors, the people raising the capital as well. It's a two-way street. But it protects the investors because it's a requirement for you, for the people that are raising the capital, to disclose everything about the deal. It's for transparency, it's for disclosure, it's for the investors to be able to look at this document, to be able to evaluate the deal on its merits, to look at the business plan, to see what they're going to do with your money, to see what fees are going to get taken, to see who's going to get those fees, to see how you're going to get paid, all those things, all the risks specifically related to that asset type, or, you know, whatever that fund or that syndication is investing in or buying, that should be disclosed. All that's laid out there so that you as the investor can make an informed decision on whether to proceed or not.
And how does it protect me, the operator?
Well, because if something goes wrong, you've already disclosed everything, right? Because that's on you as the operator to make sure that that PPM is buttoned up, to make sure that you haven't misrepresented anything, to make sure that you've disclosed all the relevant material, deal parameters, and the fees, and who's involved, and the business plan, and the risks involved. That protects you because you have now disclosed that to the investor. They have a full transparent picture of what they're getting involved in. So later down the line, investors can't say, hey, you didn't tell me about this, or hey, you didn't tell me you're going to take this fee, or you didn't tell me you're going to invest my money this way. You can say, look, we did tell you this was in a disclosure. You signed the document. So we have to assume that you read this before you entered into it.
If I was a new LP and I never have done a syndication, and I had a minute to sit with you, Seth, and say, hey, I'm a pilot, I'm flying for Delta, making good income, I just bumped into these Tate and Ryan guys, and you know, I want to do Tate's oil and gas fund, and I want to do Ryan's self-storage project. I listened to you on the episode, and you told me about these documents and how they protect me and how they protect the operator, and I'm accredited out and all that, I'm ready to go. What's something that, like, what's your warning to that pilot? Like, what would you say to them to kind of give them a heads up of, like, you know, you really want to lean in and make sure you understand, you know, these three or five things, like you really want to make sure that you're, what's kind of your advice? I mean, I know you can't give legal advice. This is just friendly conversation.
Yeah,
what kind of wisdom would you impart on that person to really get them comfortable with making a good decision?
Yeah, I think it's real. So a lot of people get enamored with projected returns. So they see that in the marketing materials, the pitch decks, the one pagers, the webinars, things like that. That's all just marketing. That's not legal documentation. So you hear about the projected returns, and sometimes you'll compare one deal to another just based on that. You know, that's where people start. That's for novice. You know, you need to get beyond that. You need to dive into the PPM, the legal docs, the operating agreement, and really take a look at how you're going to get paid as an investor. take a deep dive into that waterfall and see how you're going to get paid, what fees are getting paid out, and see if there are, for instance, other groups of membership classes that might get paid in front of you. Maybe they are made whole before you even get a single cent. Like, things like those are very, very important, because that changes the risk profile of your investment dramatically. So really dive into that waterfall how you get paid.
Just yesterday, we did a masterclass on pref equity on our private investor podcast. And talked about a senior share class to common equity and really understanding that. Anyway, shameless plug, but I love that. Sorry, Seth, to cut you off. You got anything else there?
No worries. No, for sure. I mean, that's just really important. And, the more educated you get, the more, you become aware of different types of structures. You can look and see, hey, is there a 1031 investor here involved that's going to kind of split right at the top before it even gets 100% cash flow revenue to the fund? Like, maybe there's a 1031, maybe there's an institutional partner, like you mentioned, Tate, that's going to get paid out before you do, or, they have certain rights over and above other members. There's all sorts of things like that. And the more deals that you look at and the more that you study, the easier it'll be to kind of assess a deal and really see the difference in the risk between deals that might look the same that really aren't.
Right. That have the same necessary projected returns, but might be completely different under the hood in terms of risk, in terms of strategy, in terms of timeline. So we've said this on the show before, but really the offering memorandum or the deal room, whatever you want to the marketing material for the deal, is all the ways that it can go right. And then the PPM is all the ways that it can go wrong. And you want to kind of balance those things. You can scare yourself out of a deal pretty easily if you're just looking at the PPM, because it's going to tell you all the ways that it could possibly go wrong and all the risks. So you have to read between the lines a little bit and just, have a little bit of a reasonability check and say, okay, I understand that this could go wrong, but do you think it really will? Maybe, maybe not. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, 100%. That's a great point. Don't just read the PPM and get scared off by the deal, because it's going to state every possible thing that can go wrong. It's going to talk about COVID from 5 years ago. It's going to talk about hurricanes. It's going to talk about tornadoes. It's going to talk about, a world war and recessions and all kinds of stuff. Because like we talked about earlier, it is a disclosure document. It tends to get longer and longer over time from a template standpoint, because people get sued or, people bring up different issues and they're like, ooh, we better add this to the PPM. And then it's going to be in every PPM moving forward. So you're just going to have all these like crazy risks and things that are very remotely possible in there. So don't get scared by that. I mean, take a holistic approach. Look at the positives, look at the upside, which is the, a lot of stuff in the pitch deck and the marketing materials, but then also, review the PPM and know that there are risks, especially the ones that pay particular attention to the ones that are associated specifically with, that asset type or maybe that geographical region or that city or those particular sponsors, things like that.
All right, I'm going to go on a ledge here and be a little extreme. So then what's the point of even reading it? Because if they're all going to say the same thing, right? And yeah. I'm, of course, I read all mine, and I'm not saying you don't read yours, but I always hear these surface level things, I'm being polite, because we're educating our audience, right? Somebody might be listening to this and they're like, I don't even know what a PPM is. So like, I think everything at this point has been helpful, but let's try to go a layer down, because people get a PPM and it's like, okay, this is just like the thing that you look at when you go into surgery and you sign really quick to say, hey, I could die, but you're still going to get the surgery anyway.
Right.
Right. So like, that's great. But let's be honest, like if they all have the risk that you could get COVID and things could shut down and your business could blow up and your competition could come in and gobble up all your customers, what is the point of reading the document? I mean, my kind of advice is always like, do you trust the frickin' person behind it?
Right,
because you can
put
whatever fancy stuff in the document that you want. At the end of the day, if you don't like who you're investing with, if you don't trust them to handle your money correctly, like they're going to put some nugget in the PPM that you're going to look in there and you're going to go, oh, it said they could do this or they charge these. And like people always like, make sure the waterfall is this and make sure this is that. And it's like, well, what's a good waterfall? I don't know. You know, like, I mean, like I hear like, you know, look into how much they're getting paid and what they're getting paid and how they're getting paid and all this other stuff. But it's like, I don't even know if I'm brand new. I don't even understand how that works in the first place. So what am I looking for? You know, I mean, sorry to get a little
That's a good point.
I mean, like what are we really even looking at? You know, like what's an experience? And you hear all the people on LinkedIn, oh, you know, this operator, this fees, and they're charging this before they do that and all. And it's just like, okay, like, but at the end of the day, like I talked to a very sophisticated investor yesterday, like, you know, a couple days ago. And he's just like, well, what are your waterfalls? And I kind of went through them and he's like, oh, well, you know, that's interesting or whatever. And he's like, how did you come up with that? I'm like, you know what I did? I looked at the deal. I said, what is the risk in the deal? The risk that you're taking as an investor, how much profit should you get awarded for that? And I backed into the deal that way. And some people might look at that deal and say, that's an unfavorable waterfall split. That's too many fees. And I think all this stuff is just noise. Like, because I personally, when I invest with somebody, I don't give a crap what the returns projected are. I don't care what the waterfall, maybe my opinion is subject to change, but I don't really care, because at the end of the day, what is the likeliness that I'm actually going to produce a good result from investing with this company and this person? And do they have a team behind it to get it done?
Absolutely.
That's kind of my general attitude. I don't know, Seth, what do you think about that? I mean, I'm just kind of, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, first, I would tackle the disclosures, right? And my attorneys out there that are listening, they're gonna hate this, and they're gonna probably be like, "What the hell is this guy talking about?" But like the disclosure piece, you make a really good point, right? Like a lot of the disclosures and the risks specifically are boilerplate, and depending on which securities attorney or which law firm you work for, you could probably look at all their documents, the recent ones, and they're probably fairly similar. But like I said, the ones you might want to pay particular attention to are the ones that might be deal specific. So, you know, if it has to do with those particular sponsors or management team, if it has to do with that particular geographic region or where the property is located, if it has to do with that particular asset type, and you're not maybe as an investor aware of what those risks are off the top of your head, because some of them are common sense, right? Some of them are common sense. But if it's not to you, then maybe read those particular risks and disclosures that have to do with self-storage or multifamily or an RV park or what have you. But as far as like, hey, you know, the loan could go in default, or the economy could tank, or, you know, stuff like that, you know, it's not that important, but people have gotten sued before in the past for it. So that's why it's there.
Can I try to sum up what a PPM says in 2 seconds? And you don't have to agree or disagree, but just friendly conversation.
I like this.
It says, hey, you are relinquishing all your control to this person you're giving your money to, and you could lose all of your money and be subject to further dilution through a capital call potentially as well. That's what you're doing. You're basically handing the keys of your money over to somebody else and entrusting them with the money. And you could read the PPM and you can scrutinize all the things. And I encourage you to do that. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm saying absolutely understand what you're investing in. But at the end of the day, that's what you're doing. You're basically saying, here's my money. I know I can lose it all. You're in charge. And I'm investing in an operating business that is subject to the economy. It's subject to competition, government controls, permitting, timelines, changes in the macro environment, changes in the micro environment. And I guess in my opinion, you know, I've invested in good deals and in bad deals with other people, right? I've invested with other syndicators, you know, over 20 different syndications. And the PPM has never really been the thing that's got the deal in trouble. It's always been the person has been a crappy operator or untrustworthy. And those are the two things. And like that's not disclosed in the PPM. I mean, it is disclosed that things can go wrong, but like if somebody's a bad actor and they go run off and spend all your money on something else, like, what? I mean, a PPM is not going to stop that potentially. I don't know. Maybe I'm off course here, but I do want to like sprinkle a little bit of like, don't be an engineer in the PPM too much. And miss the opportunity to put your money with the right person.
And, okay, so I have an example here that a lot of pilots are going to appreciate. So I always go back when I'm talking about a GP-LP structure, a syndication, like getting on an airplane. The GPs are the pilots. The business plan is the flight plan. The weather is the market. And you know, I have pulled up here United Airlines contract of carriage. Anybody know what a contract of carriage is? Well, you sign it every time you buy a ticket on an airline. And it says, you could die We could crash. We could lose your bag. You don't have any rights, you know, but nobody ever thinks about it because it's like, okay, well, you know, that usually doesn't happen. And I trust these pilots to be qualified and they get on the airplane, right? So it's kind of the same thing.
It's the same thing. You're investing in people. And like, I agree with you. Like, you know, every time I've had an attorney get on the phone with me and review our PPM structure, the attorney always says something to this effect. John, you realize if you invest in this, you are not in control of this and you could lose all your money and there's really nothing you can do about it. Are you tracking that? And they're like, yep. I'm like, okay, cool. Right. And that's, I mean, I don't know. I just don't want to sugarcoat that there's something in there that says much. I mean, of course, there's all kinds of things in 125 pages, but I do want to get to the 1-2 punch on it, which is that, you know? And so like, do your due diligence on the person, like, you know, go ask another Delta pilot what it's like investing with Tate. Go ask another Delta pilot what's investing like with Ryan. Like, go find your own referrals. Go find your own people who are going to speak favorably or unfavorably, you know? So just kind of do your own sort of process. And I think that's, and read your documents. But anyway, I think we spent a lot of time here, but I think it's a good conversation.
Yeah. I think that you guys are kind of sitting in a place where, and I know you guys, so like, you're trustworthy. You've had a lot of success raising capital. Like, you do the right thing with investor capital. Like, but not everybody is like that. And a lot of people may, and I've seen it, right? A lot of people will pitch a deal one way and there'll be certain things in their marketing materials. And then when it shows up in, let's say, the legal documentation, it's different. It's not how they pitched it.
That's
so that's
good
kind of something you've got to look at. So you talked about trust, right? Like, you know, trust and doing your due diligence on your sponsor, on your whoever you're going to invest with. And that's really important. Like, that's what it comes down to before you even ever get to the PPM and trying to read through those 200 pages. Like, you have to do your due diligence on those folks, talk to other investors and invest with them. And just, if you pass that test to begin with and then pass kind of the, you know, the gut instinct test, then maybe you dig into the PPM and stuff and just make sure that things are buttoned up. But I will say that some investors, some people that are raising capital are not as legit as you guys are, right? And like I said, and they're used car salesmen. They're out there just trying to sell this deal however they possibly can. They'll say whatever they need to say to get it done. And then when the legal documents show up, that deal doesn't look exactly the same as it did when it was pitched.
Yeah, that's a huge red flag.
I always say this to people. Yeah, they always say, you know, people come to me and they say, hey, can I have a copy of your OM or your PPM or whatever you're doing? Because I want to like use
it. Offering memorandum, which
yeah,
is like
memorandum.
The brochure, and PPM is the private placement memorandum, which is the legal document.
Yeah, like I was just at a conference and somebody comes up to me, they're like, hey, can I use your PPM, or your operating agreement or your offering memorandum to because I'm thinking about putting together my own deal. Can I get it? I'm like, you can copy and paste all of my materials, but it doesn't mean you can actually operate them. Right. And so I think that's the world that I fear we're going into, which is like anybody can send you a great deck and
that's
put
a great,
up a great drip campaign and they can get investors. But like, what is behind their operation? Like, how many employees? Who is the operator? Like, are they established? Like, you know, kind of going into that, like, go visit a property that they're, you know, that they have. Go see their operation on the ground. I mean, go see what it's like. You know, if they have an office, then go meet them in the office. Property tours, so I think that all that kind of stuff
it's
really
like selling
matters.
Tickets for a flight, but you don't know how to fly the airplane. Let's put it that way, right? So, all right, I think we've beat this to death. Let's move on. So, Seth, I'd like to get into the accredited investor piece. I think, like I said, I think everybody on this show knows what an accredited investor is. Probably already has an accreditation letter, but there's some nuances. And for those of you out there that are just getting into it, you know, let's spend 5-10 minutes just getting into the nitty gritty. So this is essentially the SEC saying you got to be this tall to ride the ride. If you make this much money, we don't care if you go lose it in the private markets. We're going to focus on heavy regulation in the public markets. But regulation, you know, all of the scrutiny that goes into a publicly traded company is very, very expensive. And so the vast majority of companies, you know, 87% of companies with over $100 million in top line revenue in the United States are privately held. 87%. There are only 4,300 publicly traded companies in the United States. And there are over, I think, 35 million businesses in the U.S.
Awesome.
That's just on the business side. Of course, then there's all these real estate deals and funds and private equity things. All this ocean of investments, you know, on the private side, but the SEC, for the vast majority of them, says you have to be an accredited investor in order to participate in those. So let's talk about how someone is, you know, they go, well, what does that mean? Like, how do I become accredited? And for most pilots out there, you already are. We just, for in order to participate, you need proof. So let's talk about getting that proof. And both Ryan, if you're investing with Spartan or you're investing with Turbine, it's on our platforms. It's super easy. But let's talk about the qualifications that you have to upload, because typically people are using either net worth or they're using income. I always say income is much easier to prove than net worth, and we're going to get into both. So what do people need? How much income do they need? Single, married, etc. And can they qualify either single or married if they are married? And what proof documents do they need to upload to one of these third-party verifiers?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we spoke about the basic one to begin with, which is $200,000 in income over the previous 2 years, with a reasonable expectation of the same for the current year. And if you're married and filing jointly, it would be $300,000 rather than the $200,000. So the $300,000 combined. And then the net worth would be $1 million in net worth, but that does not include equity in your primary residence.
I think where most people mess up when they're trying to qualify by net worth is they don't pull the credit report. And that's why it always kicks back and fails, and they have to re-upload stuff. Do you want to walk through, if somebody is trying to qualify via net worth, what do they need to, they sit down at their computer and they're like, okay, what do I need to go collect?
Real quick, I just want to make sure everybody understands too. Like, we're going to give you a platform.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to help you through this.
You're hearing this for the first time and you're like, oh my God, I got to get a credit report. And what am I doing? This is not like going and getting your private pilot's license. Literally at the end of the investment process, you click a link and it brings you to a portal. And it's like, how do you want to qualify? Do you want to qualify in income?
Yep.
Or do you want to qualify in net worth? And you have either or.
Yep.
Right. And you've said, hey, I want to qualify a net worth because maybe I'm not working in the last couple of years or whatever, but I've got tons of assets. And so in that process that's free, by the way, to you, the investor, it might say, hey, you need a quick credit, you know, thing. So go ahead. So, sorry, I just wanted to make sure people are oh my God, this is going to be insane to do. This is not hard at all. Right. So
right. You'll get walked through it, right? Whether it's from a third party verification company, or you can also qualify. Well, you can get a letter from your own CPA, your own attorney, or your financial advisor as well. They don't love to do that because that puts a little bit of liability on them to be able to qualify you and verify you. But they will do it. If you're a big enough client, you can make them do it. And they'll do the same thing though, or at least they should. They should get the documentation that they need from you for them to be able to sign that document and say that you are accredited. Tate, sorry, can you go into the question again, specifically what you're asking?
Yeah, and absolutely. Let me preface this by, like, why do you even need this? Well, because if you're going to invest in one of these private deals, the issuer of the security, either Ryan or me or whoever else you're investing with, is required by the SEC to have on file third-party verification of your net worth or income requirements to satisfy the requirement to be an accredited investor. Don't send us your W-2s, right? Like, we can't do anything.
And by the way, we never know how much you make or how much you have.
No, it never. Right? We never see the documents. Exactly. So it has to go to a third party, and there are companies that have started the business of just verifying accredited investors. So there's a bunch out there. There's verifyinvestor.com. There's Parallel Markets. There's Accred. Accred is actually the platform that plugs in with our investor dashboard. And so it's just an API, and it's super slick. It's like right in line. In any case, the question was, you know, most pilots are going to qualify on income because it's just more streamlined and it's easier. But if somebody's listening, they're like, oh, I need to qualify on net worth because maybe my income was down over the last couple of years, but I'm definitely over $1 million, excluding my primary residence. They sit down at their computer and they're going, okay, what do I need to pull? And typically what somebody will do is they'll pull their brokerage account statement that has more than $1 million in it, and they just upload that. But what's the problem with that?
Right. Yeah. And that's what you're talking about with the credit report, right?
Right.
Like if you look at your credit report and you can get those for free online, you can probably pull one from your bank might pull one for you or your credit card company. But yeah, that the credit report is going to pull where your debt is.
Right.
So you need to make sure that you subtract your debt.
Maybe worth.
Exactly. It's not just how much you make or how much income you have or how much equity you have in your homes or in your bank account or in your retirement accounts, you have to subtract your debt as well. So if you have student debt, if you have personal loans, if you have things like that, those things
mortgages
have to get subtracted.
On rental properties,
mortgages,
of course, not your personal
credit card debt,
doesn't
all
count.
Those things.
Right.
Yes. So it's all of your equity that you have built up from your different accounts, from maybe real estate that you own, things like that. But then you also have to subtract the debt to get your actual net worth and to be able to qualify over that $1 million mark.
Perfect. And that's, I think, what people miss is they forget that third-party verifier doesn't have a complete view of your net worth. They're just seeing the equity side. They're not seeing your debt positions. And so you have to grab that credit report, upload that, make sure that, you know, when you add up all the debt positions on your credit report, that the assets that you're uploading, you know, exceed $1 million to the positive. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Makes sense to me. And I do want to point something out,
Tate.
I don't mean to correct you, but really the qualification for that, for what we have to do as issuers,
please,
is we have to take reasonable steps to verify.
Right.
It's not necessarily a third party. Now, do we usually use a third party? Almost always. Like we're always going to get a letter from the investor's CPA, their attorney, their financial advisor, or a third party company like a CRED. To provide those letters and to take kind of that liability off of us. But there are issuers out there, people raising capital that will take those reasonable steps themselves. So there are people that will say, hey, send me your W-2, but that is very rare that happens.
And I also want to do a shout out to, if you're listening to this show and you're like, I've been investing in private placements for 20 years. I don't know what these clowns are talking about. I've never had to do this.
Yes,
I've never
good had to point. Do a, good point.
I've never had to do a letter. I've never had to do this before. What the heck are these guys talking about? I want to just kind of like, you're right. The sponsor you're investing with has probably never used the exemption that we're using.
Right.
That's
the
required.
506C versus the 506D.
This thing started in 2012.
Yep.
It protects us. It allows us to be a little bit more in the advertising
the
area, right?
Yeah.
Allows us to generally solicit. So that's why you have to do this now. It's not a matter of like, oh, like these just guys don't know what they're talking about. But the person you've been investing with for 20 plus years,
they use
has
the 506B.
Probably just been doing, yeah, which is friends and family,
yeah.
Right? And you can totally do that. So
yeah, and you don't need the accreditation letter.
Yeah, if you've been investing for a long time, I mean that this avenue didn't even exist until 2012 from the Jobs Act.
Right. That's right.
Pre that, you wouldn't even, this concept wasn't even out there.
All right, Seth, we're coming up on time. I want to completely pivot to mindset. Yeah, you are big into fitness. You talk about, you know, the blue collar mindset versus W-2 versus entrepreneur. I don't know how you do as much as you do. Do you want to, we haven't talked about the gyms, and I'd love for you to like talk about that. Talk about the business that you have with your wife on top of all the other stuff you're doing, and talk about mindset, because, you know, as pilots, we're going through the day, we're trying to do our best. We're, you know, spending time with our families. We're trying to pick up extra time so that we can invest. How do you balance all that?
You don't, you don't balance,
I like
right?
It.
Like, You don't balance, man. Like the work-life balance concept to me is a fallacy. You know, you have to put a ton of attention to things for them to be able to be successful. And that's usually puts you in an imbalanced position. So if you're trying to stand up a new company, you're probably going to be imbalanced and you're going to have to put a lot of time and energy and effort into that to stand it up, to get it going, to get momentum, be able to shift back to what we might call balance towards the middle. At that point, maybe you can become imbalanced in the other direction and give your family and your friends and your social life and that sort of thing more attention. And maybe you have a grand gesture of some sort to make up for it, whatever that looks like. But I don't think balance is something that you really need to strive for, other than maybe a balance over a long period of time.
I like that.
Like, let's say over a period of 5 years, maybe there was a balance, right? Like you can't not make any time for your family or your wife or your kids for 5 years straight, be imbalanced towards your business or investing or your career, and then expect everything to be great in 5 years. There's got to be kind of this back and forth and back and forth. And so to that extent, I guess there is a balance, but trying to stay kind of right here in the middle, it's not effective.
I think Ryan and I can both speak to that as we're super pasty white, spending 12 to 14 hours in the office every day. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, and please don't tell the people in your life that it's going to get better, because you're setting the wrong expectation. And what you should do is you should tell them it's going to be the same, more of the same, and maybe get worse, and then work like hell to not make it worse and make it better. But that's been my biggest takeaway is like, I've always been an entrepreneur since the day I was born, and I've always pushed the limits. And, everybody kind of knows me as like Ryan Gibson time, or what Ryan Gibson numbers, right? Like what do I really mean by like, oh yeah, like give it another 6 months. Well, he means 2 years, kind of thing. And so I think that setting the right expectation for those around you is much more, rewarding in this whole, like, because you're bringing people along with you usually, right? Unless you're like single or something, but if you have a family and you're starting all this stuff, like you got to be real about how long this stuff takes and how hard it's going to be.
Passive income isn't passive while you're building it. I don't know who needs to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not, there is no passive income. It's hard work.
It's passive
money.
Once it's built, it's not passive while you're building it.
Yeah. Anything worth building takes time, takes money, takes effort. It takes something. There's no free passes here.
I love that.
I think Ryan, kind of on your point, like communication and transparency is huge. It doesn't matter if you're talking about family or business, like there have to be open lines of communication and transparency and expectation setting. And that goes a long ways, right? Like if you're open about things like that and you're not just trying to smooth things over and make shit up as you go, like, that people respect that, right? Your family will respect that. Your wives will respect that. And they'll be a lot more open to you spending 12 to 14 days in the office, especially if they understand where you're coming from and it's from the right place.
Love that. Seth, how do people find more about you?
Go to SethBradleyESQ.com as in Esquire, and everything will be right there, man. You can access me via social media, free stuff, all of my different brands, those sorts of things. Come check it out.
Seth, thanks for joining us. Been a pleasure. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Thanks guys. Seth.